desire, the urgency to give oneself away to others, to the moment, to animals, to trees. Just, I've got to give myself. I can't withhold myself. It's the appreciative instinct.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico now, and I've been blessed with the third meeting in person with Father Richard Rohr here in New Mexico, and with the second chance of recording a podcast with him, of having him in our Free Radical Podcast. So far, all of my guests have come to the podcast for the first time, and I felt it's a good moment to break the rule and create exception to the rule by having Father Richard one more time with us. So in this particular occasion, I had the enormous fortune of meeting him and his dog, Opie, in his own hermitage in New Mexico. He received me in a very casual, intimate, informal way. As you will see, he's wearing his bathrobes. I was concerned when he received me like that because he knew we were planning to do a conversation, record a conversation. I asked him, but are you okay wearing those robes? I'm recording in video. If you're okay, we can do it. So yeah, these are my new robes now at this stage of my life. So it was very, very beautiful. And of course, at this point, I will say if someone like Father Richard Rohr doesn't need any introduction, apart from his own work, his own life legacy. But despite that, I'll share a few words that are coming from the bio from his latest book, The Tears of Things. Richard Rohr is a globally recognized Franciscan friar, an ecumenical teacher whose work bears witness to the deep wisdom of Christian mysticism. He's the founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, New Mexico, an educational nonprofit dedicated to introducing seekers to the contemplative Christian path of transformation. Rohr is the author of numerous books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Universal Christ. His work has been featured on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday and on Being with Krista Tippett and in the New Yorker and Harper's magazine. So today's meeting was momentous for me personally, beautiful. We touch upon so many topics. As you will see, the thread of the conversation is through a series of gifts that I personally felt inspired to bring to Richard. And through those gifts, we have been talking about different themes, different things that came very naturally in connection to my recent book as well that Richard very generously accepts, endorsed. So we are talking about evolution and divine love, specifically the eternal becoming of love, God, soul, matter. I've recently participated in one men's rites of passage organized by Richard. So also we share some thoughts about that, thoughts about the divine as dancing and celebrating existence, and thoughts about his recent book, The Tears of Things, the need for grieving collectively, the need for training prophets to offer loyal, loving criticism to one's own tradition, the need for pointing and addressing the collective evil and not so much scapegoating individuals, and a whole array of organic themes that came naturally in between all that. So this is the Free Radical Podcast. To support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. And if you feel nourished by the conversation, as we both did, by God's grace, and like it, share it, and drop out your comments so we can continue our dialogue for what it is, an ongoing conversation with infinite reality. So, dear brothers and sisters, without further ado, for a second time in our Free Radical Podcast, here is Father Richard Rohr.
So thanks so much, Richard, for welcoming us in the intimacy and
familiarity
of your home.
I hope it's worth your time.
Yeah, it is.
My dog.
Mine and thousands of
people. Yeah, he's accepted you. He can tell you're a kind person.
Thank you, Opie, for giving me entrance into the inner circle here with Richard. So yeah, we're in your hermitage. Okay, so I'm wondering, Richard, to begin with, how will you define a hermitage? Besides the obvious building-like language, what's a hermitage in a more deeper
it's
way?
It's a place apart where an individual largely lives alone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like here, other people are welcome to visit. Yeah, so you don't get antisocial.
Mm.
But your primary focus is the solitary life. Now, you're not allowed to do that till you've proven you can live in community.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not an antisocial person. You got to learn to love people first. So I lived in community my whole life. But in these last years, now I've been here.
Mm.
I'm 82, mm-hmm. going on 83. I asked permission to live as a hermit, where I could have the majority of the hours of the day silent and alone.
And gazing.
Gazing. You remember everything. Yes, gazing. Mm-hmm. That's how I pray now. I just I sit on that porch. It's too hot today, but I've been there the last few days.
Somehow, Richard, the notion of hermitage, you a few minutes ago, you used the word refugio or refuge or shelter. So how, of course, not everyone is a practitioner like you, but everyone needs shelter of some sort, especially in the world we live today. So how will you conceive the notion of a hermitage for normal people, so to say, in today's world? How will you define that?
It's where the inner life, the spiritual life, I don't know which word you prefer.
No problem.
Is so alive that it satisfies you. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be in any way, as I said before, antisocial. I sit on my porch and people come up and I talk to them. But my primary focus is not social ministry with people. Because
mm-hmm.
the soul at my age has different questions and different answers, I think. And it's no surprise, forgive my pride, but I've written, I think, my best books since I've been here.
Mm.
Did I give you my latest one?
Did
I give you my latest book?
I mean,
The Tears of Thee.
You didn't give it to me personally, but I purchased it. So you gave that to the world, so you gave that to me in a way. So
you're
thank
amazing.
You.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You're amazing.
Yeah, and we are going to your latest book in a few minutes. I want to share, of course,
okay.
some words
okay.
on that, but yeah. I'm glad. So mostly The Tears of Thee was written here.
Right here, right.
Universal Christ, similarly?
Right. Well, no, I was on retreat
mm-hmm.
with some of that
mm-hmm.
in California.
Okay.
Someone gave me their house by the sea.
Mm.
But a lot of it was written here, too. Yeah.
So lots of stuff has happened between these worlds.
I hope I die here. I'm very happy.
Mm.
It's filled with good memories.
I'm so glad to be here, really. I feel blessed, like doing some pilgrimage. For me, visiting you, Richard, not to flatter anything, but it's like doing a pilgrimage,
so
like when I go to Assisi or someplace in India, and in our tradition,
what
we like
to... What
you
see is what you are, and you are. Thank you. So, tomorrow I have a Orthodox Archbishop coming to meet me.
Hmm.
That should be interesting. I hope he's as free as you are.
Here to the Hermitage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he wants to go out to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to go out to dinner too much.
Mm.
Someone wrote, who wrote that? In a world of starving people, priest should not be eating at nice restaurants. And boy, is that true now. See those pictures of Gaza. But that's okay.
So, Richard, I, again, deep gratitude for welcoming me. And today I'm thinking whatever exchange we'll have, I would like to navigate our conversation through a series of gifts that I brought to you for you.
Oh, you're too much.
And in an attempt of reciprocation to all the gifts that you've given me personally, but I know that from whatever I may say personally, I'm speaking for thousands of people that love you and feel that you have enriched their life in many unique ways. So I will be giving you some gifts, and I invite the audience of those who feel themselves gifted by Richard. Like, whenever I give him a gift, you can think that you are yourself giving Richard the gift and thanking
thank
him
you
for
ahead of time
for everything that he gave to you. So yeah. So first gift I like to give you, and it may look quite ordinary, but it's okay. There is a lot of gifts in ordinariness, right? As you probably always
you know. Give it, it's not ordinary.
Some ginger beer that I know you love.
I just bought some beer.
Oh, really?
Yesterday.
I remember in our first
ginger beer.
I remember in our first meeting, I gave you. Yeah, it's a little heavy, so if you want, we can keep it here. But if you want later, we can open one bottle. I brought the strongest one, just in case.
You know, I'm not a prude. I'm German.
It's in the DNA.
In the DNA.
Yeah, I remember our first visit when I was with Bhakti Ras and Sumati, two members of our community, and we prepared some feast for you, and ginger beer was there. You liked it a lot, and our last day we got a pack of that, and you were very happy with that. So there is not much philosophical things that I can draw from the ginger beer at this precise moment, but it's a gift. So I'm thinking, in terms of gifts, what will you say are the, if you will have to select three main gifts that you have received in your life and you continue to receive of your life that make your life not only bearable, so to say, but worthy of living to the highest degree?
Three.
Yeah, I know it's difficult to limit it to a top three, but whatever comes first.
Well, I think that I joined the Order of St. Francis, which emphasized humility, non-performance, if I could call it that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. That was the best decision I ever made. It was like a married man might say, the best thing I did was get married. Franciscan spirituality has guided my life. Not that I've always lived up to Francis's radicalism, but it's been a guiding star. Secondly, what flowed directly from that, I call it a spirituality of subtraction.
Subtraction.
Quoting Meister Eckhart, have you heard of that name?
Yeah.
He was a German too.
You quote him quite often, so that's how I came to know about him.
The way I put it is, we come to God by doing it wrong, not by doing it right. It's just, for most puritanical Christians, that's just such a total insight. They don't consider it an insight.
That's what I was going to say. Hopefully they consider
heresy.
That.
Heresy. No, you come to God by doing it right. If that's true, none of us are going to make it.
There's not much hope with that. Yeah.
Whatever enlightenment is, whatever salvation is. What's the third?
Maybe something that you feel is a special grace that has come to you under your recent years of life?
Well, I believe that we're all just walking one another home, as someone put it. I believe, and I don't want to get caught up in the theological intricacies of this, but what the Christian tradition called a heresy, universal salvation.
Mm-hmm.
God is bringing everything home.
Mm.
And it's not some people who get it and some who don't. We all don't get it, and we're all brought back to God.
Mm.
So I believe in universal salvation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you can publish this after I'm dead. When I can't,
the top three of Richard Rohr.
They can't burn me at the stake anymore.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
Many early fathers of the church did, like Origen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not new to me. I believe actually St. Paul did. Salvation is a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Mm.
When.
Mm.
We're all being saved by the grace of God, we're all being brought mm-hmm. into union. That's what salvation means. To live in union. So that's my only, that God gave me the courage and the experience to believe that is certainly my third, since you asked.
Thank
for
you.
Three.
Yeah. I know there could be so many more. And I really want to thank you for that point on salvation that I learned from you some time ago. And I recall even last year when I was in the donors retreat, and at one point, someone asked you to give a blessing to the meeting, like a few words of blessing for the meeting. And you mentioned something like, let us stop wondering whether we are saved or not. No, that question has been answered a long time ago.
Resolved.
So that's also we can spend our time asking better questions, so to say.
Oh, thank you.
So that was
you're a good listener. Thank you.
And you are a good speaker, so I have to be a good listener to honor that.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, let's continue with the second gift that is somehow related to something I talked to you about before we started the recording, which is my visit to the Men's Rites of Passage a few weeks ago, 1 week ago in California. So here I have a group picture of all the men. Maybe it's too dark. Do you want me to turn on the light?
Turn on it right there by the door. Okay. Ooh, I don't want to see it.
As you can see, I didn't lie
to you.
Oh, my
God.
It's a big group.
It was a big group.
I was not exaggerating, trying to impress you. We were like,
look
something.
At that. Some have said that's the only thing I'm going to be remembered for, was creating that 5-day event.
Hmm.
Mostly white guys, isn't it?
There are a few exceptions, yeah.
Few exceptions, yeah.
But probably mostly white guys. Probably white guys are the ones who need it the most. So that's good.
There you go. That's good. We white guys. What a beautiful picture.
Yeah. So that's the official group picture. And yeah.
The team is on here too.
Yeah. Everyone is there. I'll leave the picture for you if you later
Please.
Want to go through the faces.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised I don't.
Bob is there, Jim is there, Kareem is there.
Who gave the talks? Do you remember?
Jim was one of the main ones, along with Kareem and Giovanni as well.
Giovanni, I don't see him. He's Guatemalan. You know?
We have some nice Spanish conversation.
Did you?
Yeah.
He's so proud of being Guatemalan.
Yeah, lots of very nice storytelling and poems shared as well. And
oh, thank you.
Please. I'll leave this here as well with the list, the other gift that we'll be bringing. But I wanted to thank you again, as I told you before, for creating this particular safe space and vessel, sacred vessel for men to really dare to be men, to be brave and courageous, as Brené Brown will equate vulnerability with courage, that sometimes men do not do well in that. They think being brave is the opposite of being vulnerable.
That's right.
And you're creating an experiential vessel for men to really feel, to be a man, actually, to be brave and courageous means to be vulnerable.
Such a paradox, huh? Yes.
To embrace my wounds, to cry, to acknowledge my brokenness.
I didn't see you. Where are you in the picture?
I'm in the exact center, interestingly. I went to the back since I'm one of the tallest ones. So that's me there.
You didn't wear your robe?
No. I didn't want to scare anyone there. I was even called by my birth name, secular name, because no titles were allowed.
Which is what?
It's Diego.
Oh, Diego.
Yeah, but somehow I tried to make a play of words to make even have deeper sense. So I make Die and put a hyphen and I put ego. So it's Die Ego.
So, ah, very good.
A death to the false self in Thomas Merton.
Wow. He was a Franciscan. Well, you were probably named after St. James.
James will be Diego in English, right? Yeah.
We have a Spanish Franciscan, San Diego. Mm. That's what the mission.
That's a city in the United States called.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Well, thank you. My pleasure.
And
beer and a picture.
And we're just warming up. There are a few more coming.
You know how to love people. It's a shame you're not marrying somebody.
Well, I'm trying to marry the whole world. And
there you go.
We are trying, yeah. So in that retreat, Richard, I'm thinking some of the highlights for me that you yourself mentioned in books like Adam's Return or From Wild Man to Wise Man is this idea of the need for grieving, to have a place and time and space for grieving, and the point that you made that we cannot grieve alone, but we need to grieve collectively. I don't know if you have anything else that comes to you about why we cannot grieve alone and why actual grieving, healing grieving, can be communal.
I'm convinced the last book, The Tears of Things, mm-hmm. Lágrima in Spanish. So
yeah, Lágrima. Yeah.
Lágrima. You pronounce it like a G, log?
Yeah. In Latin it's Lágrima and in Spanish it's Lágrima.
Lágrima.
Yeah.
Is why Jesus said, how happy are those who weep. I think grieving, weeping is a spiritual path. It's the path of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. You already mentioned it. Mm. And we men are taught to not cry because it'll look like a woman. Mm. It'll look feminine, as if that's bad.
Yeah.
So you probably heard me say, let me see here if they still quote me. They're supposed to be true to the talks.
That's it.
I used to say, a lot of you think your father was angry, and maybe he was.
But behind that, he was sad.
Sad, yeah.
Okay.
Do they still say it?
If you still say it?
No, on the
retreat?
Right, on the retreat.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
That was an important main point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of you think you are angry. Mm-hmm. But you are really sad. Mm. That is a turning point for many men. Who gave the grief talk? Do you remember?
Mm.
No, it doesn't matter. Okay. Curious.
Yeah. I will say some among those three mostly, Giovanni, Jim, or Karim, though they were invited guests to give
Jim Clark.
Probably, but different guests gave their testimonies as well. And again, in one sense, all of them were grief talks in one way or another.
Sure, right? That's right.
But I really see a very embodied, powerful example of why we need to do it collectively and why for men in particular it's so difficult to do it by themselves. And when you see someone else doing it, it gives you permission to, it gives your tears permission to... to come out. So
did they tell you about how I was taken to the caves of grief in Africa?
Yes.
The Maasai.
Yes.
They freed two warriors to walk with me for 2 days and take me to every place in the caves of grief. They said, here we had to learn to cry for the world.
Mm.
I said, my God, that's profound spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And we call them pagans. Yeah.
So, of course, as you are quoting, Richard, it's all this is quite tied to your latest book, The Tears of Things. It speaks about grieving, and you say that all things have tears in it and all things deserve tears. Right?
God, you've got it memorized. You're right. All things have tears. All things deserve tears.
Hmm. and in that context, you even describe, you spoke about salvation a few minutes ago, and how to think in those terms, all things have and deserve tears, is in itself a form of salvation, you mentioned in your book.
To be able to surrender to that.
Yeah. To embrace that fact for what it is.
Yeah. We have an English phrase, the tragic sense of life.
Mm.
Life isn't something to be fixed. It's something to be wept over.
Mm-hmm.
And thus enter into solidarity with it. The Spanish book is being translated, as is the Portuguese. And they don't know what to do with the tears of things.
How to translate put the title into Spanish.
Cosas.
That's one of the things I thought in my Spanish side of the brain. How will they put this title?
They don't know. They have
falling upward, also I remember, they translate into Spanish, not in the literal way.
Literal, yeah. I haven't heard
what
the Spanish title is, but it's not
Las lágrimas de las cosas.
No. That's what
I'm sure they will come with
the
something.
The editor said it makes no sense.
Yeah, that's how I struggle with my own books when I have to translate them into,
really?
Because there is always some play of words into the English language that doesn't work into the Spanish.
English isn't a pretty language, but it does have a lot of words.
Yeah.
More than most of the world languages, which makes it hard for you to learn it.
Unfortunately, I went to study English when I was like 6 or 7.
Oh,
so
that's why you have no accent. Okay.
So, Richard, in the tiers of things, you give this, of course, general thread of the Hebrew prophets, like being, most of them at least, being depicted first as angry men, then sad men, and then after embracing the grief, like redeemed.
Compassion
and redemptive.
And
man,
so you can even praise God, Yahweh, as they called it, out of their sadness.
Mm-hmm. So will you say that this sequence of anger, sadness, compassion is kind of a universal archetype that
that's
Hebrew prophets
I'm trying
are
to prove
pointing
in
to?
The book.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard to do.
Yeah,
if you read, and I taught the prophets for 20 years here at the center.
Mm-hmm.
So I had plenty of time to go through the text by paragraph by paragraph, chapter by chapter. And there I found the pattern. Anger first, sadness later, compassion at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even praise, which they call doxology in Greek. Did you ever learn Greek? No.
No. I mean, I know some words, mostly many because of you, like perichoresis and so on and so forth.
Perichoresis,
yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful word, language for sure.
It is.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Four words for love.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Agape, eros, philia. Give me the last one.
The fourth one everybody forgets.
Give me the last
storge. It's like my love for my dog. I think it's Eros, but they would call it storge. Our love for my little hermitage.
Okay.
That's storge.
Okay.
It's not even a pretty word.
Hmm.
But just that they would have enough discrimination, the Greeks.
Yeah.
Say one word
is
not adequate.
It reminds me of the Sanskrit language from my tradition. They have so many words for love.
Do they?
Priti, Rati, Bhava, Prem, Kama, I mean, long list.
Oh my God.
And also indicating.
You're the first one who's told me that.
Mm-hmm. That there is a lot of that.
Yeah. And we just have love. Almost makes you think we're not very practiced at it. Something.
So, two things from your book, Richard, that really personally struck me. I mean, the whole book is a masterpiece, and I believe that you also feel a humbling pride in the end result of the work.
I feel content with what I know I had to say before I die.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And probably, first of all, I will ask a question that many of the listeners may be asking. Is this really your last book?
Yes. I mean, you're going to be able to tell my mind isn't very good. I forget everything. I can't type very well.
Mm-hmm.
My fingers don't work well. So it's my last. No more books.
It's totally fine. I mean, your books are such nature. One can go over through them over and over again, and they're always new.
I hope so.
So two things that struck me personally the most. One is your emphasis on the need of the prophet as a role for any tradition, as you will say, even to have a seminary in holy disorder to train people to perform, so to say, that function. That was very important for me to realize the religion, the culture itself should shelter those people,
encourage,
nourish them.
Mm-hmm. Self-criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a function for that in most cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, I know people, when I was a young priest, used to say, what kind of priest are you? Why don't you leave the church? You're criticizing it all the time. But I criticized it because I loved it.
Yeah, exactly.
Not because I hated it.
Because you care.
And people can't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
The prophet understands that.
Mm.
You know? Yeah.
And the moment we don't have prophets who are criticizing out of love, we lose all objectivity. And
every religion becomes idolatrous,
mm-hmm.
corrupt.
Yes, you say the healthy place to stay is on the edge of the east
the
end,
edge.
Right?
Oh, God, you're such a student. Christians learn me as well as you do. What else?
And the second point that really hit me was the importance that you made of when we find some individual shortcoming or failure in an individual in any religious group, we shouldn't over-concentrate on the fall down of the individual, but see the systemic evil, as you will say, or let the corporate sin. So and address that instead of just scapegoating the
individual bad person.
Mm-hmm. I see so much in my tradition. That's my point.
That's not so going to save the world, exposing bad people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Except insofar as they are expressing the cultural lies that we all agree to.
Mm-hmm.
I think of America, consumerism, gun culture, pride. That's our sin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're not supposed to talk about that. Mm-hmm. You're just supposed to find individual adulterers or something.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time. It really is.
Yeah. Many times individuals may start with very good heart and intention, but they end up signing a contract with a systemic evil that they cannot see originally.
You get it. My God, you get it. Thank you.
And you're only 40. Thank you.
Lord,
thank you.
Way ahead of time.
Okay, I'll stop you praising me and I will continue with the next gift, Richard.
I can't wait. They just get better.
So this is hopefully this is getting better. This is the first printed copy of my forthcoming book, the third one that you were generous enough to write an endorsement with. And you gave me permission to include that
on
the cover. You are too generous there. Please don't read the endorsement aloud because I feel embarrassed of how generous you're being to me.
I won't read it aloud.
Whomever wants to read Richard's endorsement, you can get the book, no problem. So by the time our conversation will be published, the book has been published a few weeks ago.
Oh, you're more handsome than this picture. I show.
Yeah, there are a few friends of you also there. Brian McLaren wrote something. Ilia Delio. Yeah.
When did it come out?
They will be officially launched on July 5th.
Oh, it's still going to come out.
In a few weeks. But our conversation will be published a few weeks after it's launched. But I recall that.
I'm honored to have my name on the front of your book and the back.
I'm honored to have your name on the front and the back of my book. Yeah, thank you.
Jeffrey Love, Hinduism in America.
Yeah.
Ilia is taught here.
Yeah, there are a few other endorsements inside the book. Carmen Acevedo, the butcher, is also there.
She's so dear.
Yeah. So anyhow. Actually, originally, Richard, I didn't think about inviting you to write an endorsement, not because of something in particular, not wanting you to be there, but I thought you are too busy. I don't want to take your time. And I already have all of the endorsers. And I was in New Zealand, I remember, at the beginning of this year, and I was praying. And somehow something came like, you try to ask Richard for an endorsement. Probably he will agree. You try. And I remember writing you an email, and you basically reply within minutes saying, yes, please send me the book.
How could I refuse?
So that was so generous. So generous. So as you know, Richard,
great gift.
The title is Evolution in Divine Love, and the subtitle is The Eternal Becoming of God, Soul, and Matter. So as you know already, of course, you went through the book a little bit. So
who's the publishing house?
Actually, it's a publisher house called Inward Publications. Yeah.
What city?
It's in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Yeah. So you are to blame in big part for this book in terms of the inspiration. Yeah. You and other Christian authors like Ilya Delio, you really have inspired me to enter into this conception of love as ever evolving, of a dynamic God, of us in evolution, of looking at the world of matter as following along with God's evolution. And then I went back to my tradition to only discover that all those truths are there. But sometimes I need someone else to point that to me, as it used to be the case.
That's why we need other religions to affirm what's true in our own religion. And you're the oldest. Hinduism is much older than Christianity.
It's quite old, and it's there. But again, I sometimes need people from my tradition to point to things to me, but also sometimes I find people like you or Ilya or others by their words pointing to me like, okay, this is what it is about. So I like to share with you one section of the book and hear your thoughts if you give me permission. Which somehow summarizes what the book is about. So it says like this. I won't make it too long. Evolutionary thinking sends us on a trajectory where the ride is itself the destination and the goal is never clearly in sight. To stay on the ride, to trust the trajectory, to know it is moving, and moving somewhere always better, is just another way to describe faith. We are all in evolution all the time.
I said that?
It's a part from the book. You like it?
Yes.
You say that then. Sorry to play that trick on you. I didn't want to stole the quote from you. It's rightly quoted under your name. But I did this because I really love to see you whenever someone tells you something and you say, oh, that was great. And they tell you say that. Me?
So, it's a genuine surprise.
Yeah.
I said that?
Yeah. So that's very humbling, and that speaks how the Holy Spirit speaks through you.
Yes.
We cannot claim ultimate authorship. So which are your thoughts on that idea? Like life as an ongoing journey and always moving to something better. At this stage of your life, how do you live those words?
You know, I watched a PBS series the last few days. Mm-hmm. Called Walking with Dinosaurs. You probably don't waste time on TV.
No. I will follow your footsteps. Walking with the Dinosaurs. Okay.
It was very well done.
Mm-hmm.
But it kept recurring in this four different part how they were killed 66 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're still finding their fossils, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just that.
Mm-hmm.
How can you? And what was God doing for a million? We think that 1 year is so long. A million years, 66 million.
Mm-hmm.
Before any of our world religions existed.
Mm-hmm.
And these big lumbering animals were walking, now they found on every planet. Except Antarctica. Just
in every continent.
Yeah, every continent, what did I say? Yeah.
Hmm. era.
Who is God? Mm. 66. And then they had already lived maybe 70 million years.
Mm-hmm.
If I heard the show correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
70 million years of lumbering giant animals walking around. What was God? How are they building up the kingdom of God, as we call it? Who is saved?
Mm.
It's just, it plunged me back in the mystery.
Mm.
And humility. Humility. And of course, a lot of fundamentalist Christians deny the existence of dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
They deny. You can hold a fossil right in front of them. No, it isn't a fossil. That's how we just are afraid of truth.
Okay, recall how you make somehow that case in the universal Christ when you say, okay, it's not that Christ only came 2,000 years ago and before that there was no God, no Christ,
yeah,
no grace.
What's going on?
What happened during the majority of history?
So history, evolution keeps us humble, keeps us in the presence of what is still utter mystery. And what's so compelling today is that many scientists are more surrendered to that mystery than a lot of us who are monks and friars and nuns and priests.
More open to perpetual wonder disclosure. And acknowledging their methods are not ultimately perfect and correction.
On this particular show, you had archaeologists digging in one little spot with a brush and a pick. And they sit there for months on end.
Mm. Yeah, that's a type of contemplation.
Yes, a type of contemplation. And a kind of humility about life.
Yeah.
That we religious people would do well to imitate.
And a very committed sense of inquiry, right? Like passionate
inquiry. That's a good word.
Passionate inquiry, right?
And the things they can figure out about how dinosaurs lived just from their bones. It was just, I went to bed happy every night. Contemplating dinosaurs. And I was not one of those kids who grew up in awe of dinosaurs.
Yeah, yeah.
But I am now.
Okay, I was one of those kids.
Were you on
I will review my childhood by watching the series again.
Is it the same word in Spanish? Dinosaur?
Dinosaurio.
Dinosaurio.
Very similar. Very similar. Yeah. So, Richard, going from dinosaurs to love, which is the first chapter of my book, is how love is ever evolving. The book has four chapters, right? So
you illustrate
love being ever evolving, God being ever evolving, the soul being ever evolving, and matter being in constant evolution. So in my first chapter, I tried to say, okay, we are talking about love, so let's first define love, because probably love is one of the words.
I can't wait to hear.
No, I can't wait to hear
your definition. No, I don't know.
I brought the book. You can find it. But because we use that word so often, probably it's one of the words we use the most. Love, and those are the words we understood the least sometimes. So how will you define love in any coherent way today? If someone will ask you, Richard, what's love? So we can use the term. And again, we were talking about different words for love in other languages. We only have love. But if you have to give one definition.
The desire, the urgency to give oneself away to others, to the moment, to animals, to trees. Just, I've got to give myself. I can't withhold myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's the appreciative instinct.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy it here on my front porch. When I take you out, you see there's a dumpster across the parking lot. And someone's spray painted "I love you" on the dumpster.
Okay.
And I don't know how long it had been there before I said, well, look at that. I sit here all these times.
I'm sure you had a good gazing in that direction.
Right? I was gazing toward the dumpster. Even the dumpster is reflecting back when you appreciate it.
Mm.
Opie goes behind the dumpster to poop.
Mm.
He's got his dignity. Well,
he knows
it.
We were talking about him.
Look at him.
Yeah, it's about you now. So considering that definition of love, like the urgency of giving yourself away to all things, do you agree with the idea, following that idea of love, that love can never become its opposite, real love, but can only become more of what it is? By nature.
It grows by its very nature.
Yeah, if
we are... it doesn't flip into its opposite. Mm-hmm. When it's disappointed,
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm,
betrayed,
mm-hmm,
it's tempted to,
mm,
but it doesn't.
Mm.
Yeah. Once you make contact with what we call agape love,
mm-hmm,
divine love.
Nope.
Did you use the Greek word? You didn't use
I mentioned agape and eros briefly, but I mostly refer to some of our Sanskrit terminology. Yeah. And in that connection, Richard, what do you think of this idea that love, if love is always growing and expanding, in one sense, in our tradition, and I put that in my book, love in one sense is the ultimate necessity, but also love creates the ultimate necessity in the form of more love, further love, like an unquenching thirst for greater depth, greater breadth of love. Do you think we could speak about a form of holy dissatisfaction in love?
Holy,
you are fulfilled.
By its very nature, it expands.
Yeah. So it may give fulfillment. I'm complete. I'm loving. But also it creates some longing for more.
Dissatisfaction.
Again, some paradoxical.
That I still haven't begun to love.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that so strongly in my 83rd year. My God, I haven't begun.
Which in our tradition,
people like you who love.
In our tradition, we'll say that's a perfect symptom of someone who loves, that they feel, I do not love. Because you have a taste of that infinite ocean and you realize there's so much more to be loved.
How beautiful. How beautiful.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're being my teacher right now. Thank you.
You are being my teacher by allowing yourself to continue learning.
I can't wait to read this. And I don't read much anymore.
Yeah, that's why I hesitated about sending the original for you to write an endorsement, but you still accept it.
I'm glad you quoted me in favor of it.
Thank you. The second chapter, Richard, after love being ever evolving, I continue to make the case, okay, if love is ever evolving, then God, who is love, is in constant evolution as well.
God becoming.
Yeah, but also we have in our tradition, your tradition, the notion of God being changeless, right? So again, will you say we have this paradox here? God is changeless because probably he's always God, because he's always love, because he's always changing. That's changeless about him. He's always growing in love. How will you explain this paradox?
It is. What doesn't change...
Mm-hmm.
And the Hebrew word for it was hesed.
Mm.
It was usually translated mercy.
Mm-hmm.
Steadfast love.
Mm-hmm.
Divine love is steadfast.
Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it doesn't change.
It doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
So people who think even the God of the old, so-called Old Testament,
mm-hmm,
changed his mind.
Mm.
All he can change is deeper, steadfast love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I learned from the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
They so come to steadfast love. You cannot keep God from loving once God has formed what they called covenant love with his creation. Then it is never withdrawn, never.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing we can do, nothing we can say,
yeah,
can make God withdraw until religion learns that. I don't know what use religion is. I really don't. Yeah. It's more a part of the problem than the solution. Because we Christians anyway, keep deciding who God has decided not to, to love.
Yeah. And in that connection, I think, and I'm something I speak in the book, and you taught me that a lot, which is in order to know God, we need to unknow God.
Unknow.
No, I always recall this phrase of yours, like, the last experience of God is frequently the greatest obstacle to the to next, experience.
You are a student.
You are a teacher.
Yeah, well, thank you for listening so well.
And yeah. You have any thoughts on that of how to deconstruct the great? Do you see that as a great temptation to put God in a box once again and once again? Now I got it. Now I understood it. Now I control it. Now I own him. Instead of remaining in a space of, as you say, mystery and disclosure and never being certain enough, though there is some deep certainty.
The medieval mystics had this metaphor, a cloud of unknowing, that after every theophany, Zion, Tabor, those are in the Christian Bible, Jewish Bible, it's covered by a dark cloud. And they saw that as a metaphor. You thought you saw God, but just remember, you don't know it all. That's brilliant. Mm-hmm. After the fights of the Protestant Reformation, where we all needed to prove we were right, Christianity lost that.
Mm.
It just fought about being right, and not just being right, being certain.
Mm.
You've heard me say it more than once.
The opposite of faith.
Go ahead. Is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certitude.
I cannot tell you how many times I quote that in my lectures and how many times people fail to say, what's the opposite of faith? Doubt. And when I say certitude, I really throw them into uncertainty.
Yes.
What's going on here? Beautiful.
You picked all the important things that I've said.
Well, difficult not to find
and
an important thing.
I learned them from other people.
Mm.
What else?
Third part of the book, I speak about the soul then. Now, the love is ever-evolving. God is ever-evolving. And we, in our tradition, we describe the soul as a unit of potential for better and for worse, right? We can go into very darker directions with all the potential we have, or we have a very bright potential. And we are seen by God according to our bright potential. I remember you used that term darshan, which is a Sanskrit term for falling upward. Yeah. And darshan sometimes is translated as seeing, but actually it can be translated as being seen.
Being seen.
So how we are being seen by God in terms of our brightest potential, not in terms of the
that's
mess.
Lovely.
In terms of the mess we still are,
that's lovely.
Our past, future, but of all we can be. So, and of course, if we are seen by that, by God, we are invited to see everything and everyone in the same way, right? To return the gaze, as you will say.
We long, if you are lucky enough to have at least one loving parent who delighted to look at you as a little boy, as a little girl. You look for that gaze the rest of your life to be repeated. Someone who just delights that you exist.
Mm-hmm.
I got it, I think, from both my mother and my father. So the spiritual life was predictable for me.
But will you say if someone didn't receive that gaze from any of their parents, still they will look for that, or maybe they end up being cynical about that doesn't exist.
But God understands
that
cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't programmed for it. They can't believe it. So God can't wait to give it to them at death.
Yeah.
Look at it with love.
Mm.
I believe that.
And that sounds like salvation, and that takes me to one part of the book that I mentioned regarding salvation that we touched upon before. That sometimes many religious people in every tradition, not only yours, but not only mine, we think that when we think about being saved, we think I'm saved from instead of what I'm saved for.
Very good. Very good.
That's for me the real question, because as you say before, if you're already saved, you stop asking that question. Then the question is, okay, what I'm saved for?
For, yes.
So it has a whole.
I had a beautiful wedding up at Ghost Ranch last weekend of our director, who married a street doctor who takes care of the homeless.
Mm.
It was so easy to preach. But I pointed out how Jesus' consistent metaphor for the end of history, the end of time, whatever that means, is always a wedding banquet. Only once is it a courtroom scene.
Okay.
Matthew 25. And that's to do with our rejection of the poor. There, he makes it a courtroom scene. But wouldn't you know it, the Christian tradition has continued to train most people to fear the final judgment as a big courtroom scene. When it's even in the Sistine Chapel, it's judging Jesus, just dividing the sheep from the goats. I don't know how we're going to turn that around. I try in the book.
You try hard and you try well. Yeah. For me, in the Sistine Chapel that I visited last year, first time.
Oh, you've been there.
Yeah. I was, a friend of mine has a friend who works in the Vatican Museum. So he took me for like 5 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
There was so much good art that at point all my senses kind of shot because it was too much content.
You closed down.
Not complaining, just it's a way of praise, but it was too much in the good sense. But it all concludes in the Sistine Chapel, and for me the main image and how I interpreted it is the famous painting,
the finger.
And for me, again, I know different people understand it differently, but it means like, for me, it's God's desperate attempt to extend himself, his grace.
Lovely.
And sometimes our lack of interest, that we are more like bored. Should I do it or not? I don't know, calculating the profit of
good.
That Richard, the last part of the book is about matter, because I felt I needed to include this world nature, not only God, love, us, but this world is evolving. As God's heart is evolving, I put this world is evolving alongside God, in tandem with God's heart.
That's right.
And in at least in our tradition, God is omnipresent and he's inhabiting every atom. So in one sense, this sofa is worshipable. It's sacred.
Yes. I have no trouble with that.
You taught me that lesson very, very deeply. I'm really.
You know it already, intuitively.
So yeah, I try to make that point in the book that really the material world is sacred. If God is in every atom, and if God is love, in one sense we could say that the universe is primarily composed of feelings or emotions, because God is inhabiting every pore of creation, so to say.
Yes.
And I will say my tradition as well as yours speaks about the backdrop of creation being, again, God's overflowing love, right? Like kenosis, like in Christian traditions.
Self-emptying.
Like self-emptying, and the world comes as an emptying of God's heart.
Yeah. Every created thing
is
St. Bonaventure, one of our Franciscan mystics, he said everything is a fingerprint or a footprint of God. Vestigia in Latin, vestige in English. Or we believed creation was the first Bible and the best Bible. That's why dinosaurs are allowed to teach me. They were already manifesting God. Dinosaurs. Millennia, millions of millennia before the Bible was written. That's one thing you have in your favor as a Hindu. You're not as bound to the book as the three religions of the book.
I mean, we have our books, and we can indeed become bound to them. But
yes. but mostly we fight over their meaning instead of gazing at that tree and knowing all we need to know. You're a wonder for a man as young as yourself. Wow, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for writing this.
Just to wrap up, I don't want to take much of your time, but I have a few more gifts to share with you, if you allow me.
You never stop. You're a gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, regarding what we were mentioning in our tradition, creation is conceived as, again, God's heart being poured in the form of this world. And we have even the word lila in Sanskrit, which means kind of a celebratory play. And we conceive of the divine as absorbed in celebration of existence, like playing and dancing. And
I read that, yes.
And this world coming as a byproduct of that celebration. Yes. So in that sense, I want to give you a gift, which actually belongs to, as you today mentioned, that the day, like today we are recording this episode, June 21st, is 4 years anniversary since you visited Pope Francis. Pope.
And today I visit another Argentinian Pope.
And also on a day like today, a dear friend of mine, he passed away a few years ago. Oh. And the gift I will give you was from him. So this is a beautiful carved image of Krishna, which is one of the main forms that we conceive the divine in our tradition. It's beautifully done. And as you can see, he's playing
ebony.
So he's playing the flute, as you can see, and he's like curved in three, so like in a moving pose. Like we are talking about God being ever evolving. For us, God is like not only moving but dancing. Well, some of the names for God in our tradition is the King of Dancers, and the flute playing represents like the clarion call to the soul that God is calling each one of us to celebration. And I always recall your mentioning in the Trinity, in the book of the Divine Dance, also perichoresis again, and the Trinity on a dance of love and celebration. So I don't know if you have
a lotus underneath.
Yeah. The lotus is also a symbol not only of beauty but of something that is born from the mud. At the same time, while remaining rooted to the mud, it blossoms above it. No, so ordinariness and extraordinariness connected.
And is this lotus too on the back, you think?
I will say so, yeah.
And
yeah,
on top.
Yeah, there are lotuses everywhere. In our tradition, we have this description of the lotus feet of God, his lotus face, his lotus navel. Actually, my name, Swami Padmanabha, means lotus navel. Padma means lotus and Nava means navel. So every part of God's body, so to say, if we want to describe it as such, is described like a lotus, which again has its roots in mud and it grows above it.
Do you think?
Any thoughts that come to you when contemplating this little gift?
Do you think it's crude to see the flute as a phallic symbol?
We never thought it that way. I have no problem. We have this in our tradition. We have this phallic symbol called lingam.
Lingam.
Which is worshipped in India.
Yeah.
And the lingam comes from a yoni, which is kind of like a womb.
Vagina.
So it's very overt. So in that sense, I'm not shocked by the suggestion.
No, I knew you wouldn't.
But in our case, the flute, we will say Krishna plays a bamboo flute. So bamboo flutes are like a bamboo stick that is hollow on the inside. So it speaks about emptying ourselves, as you were speaking before, so God can blow through us. And also refers to the call to God is always calling. So for us in our tradition, every time Krishna is depicted, he's always playing the flute, he's always dancing, like always calling, always moving, always celebrating, never getting tired of that, so to say.
When I was young in the Hare Krishna danced on the streets.
I can imagine you saw them a few times.
Yeah, a lot. I always envied their joy, their freedom. They didn't mind everybody thinking they were crazy.
That was pretty countercultural, I can imagine. I mean, the hippies time it was that's how it exploded in the West. So anyhow, I will put this on my quasi altar. My honor.
It deserves it to make me think of you. And I hope they take care of it after I pass.
Mm.
Which won't be too long.
Let me put this on my side for a moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
And let me conclude with one last gift.
One last gift for now.
Because you spoke a few minutes ago about the wedding banquet that I really appreciate in connection to Jesus' main also depiction of the kingdom of God, like a feast, like a big feast. So I'm already spoiling you with ginger beer and Brooks and pictures. I was not able, this is as much as a banquet as I can bring here. So these are a few cookies.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, these are made by Bhakti Rasa, who made the feast 2 years ago when we first met. Yeah. Yeah. So just
tell me what makes these special.
I mean, they are made with love. they are made with almond flour. They're very healthy.
Almond.
Yeah, they have no white sugar. They will, I'm sure you
can
may
I
like
share
them.
Share one with you?
If you want, we can break bread together here.
There we go.
Thank you.
Do you know the almond cookie was Francis's? He was a bit of an ascetic, which he repented at the end of his life.
Oh, here's someone coming from.
The almond cookie was.
Can I give
his? Open. Oh yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. We are all partaking.
One delicacy Francis would allow himself.
Almond cookie.
So on his.
This was not on purpose. I didn't know that one. That's a good way to end up that note.
On October 3rd, the anniversary of his death, we treat ourselves to almond cookies.
Mm.
So that's.
Okay,
that's
we'll include that in our tradition. Great, beautiful. We didn't know that at all. So for me, it's like very connected, this notion of the topic of my book on the ever-evolving dance of celebration, the banquet that Jesus is describing, the endless feast. In our tradition, sacred food, we generally prepare it, trying to offer that to God, and we even recite some prayers. He likes it. In Sanskrit, we call consecrated food prasad. So prasad means consecrated food, and it also means grace or divine grace or divine mercy. And in our tradition,
food that was offered in the temple.
Yeah, yeah. But also besides the food offered, the word for grace or mercy, one of them is prasad. And in our tradition, there are many stories of God feeding his devotees. And there's one word in Bengali, which is akanta, which means up to the neck. So there are descriptions that he will feed his own servants till they...
Up to the neck.
They cannot eat more, like representing grace and mercy, how God is feeding us up to the neck.
Is it appropriate that we drink some of that ginger beer?
It's totally appropriate, yeah. This opens naturally like this, or when it's...
Let's see. Oh, it does. Good.
Yeah.
You drink first.
No, please. And you can take it all. It's all for you. No problem.
200% more ginger than original.
Hope he's looking for more.
Is there any alcohol? Non-alcohol.
No.
It's non-alcohol.
Yeah. Just ginger. The strongest one. So I hope
How
it's
about
not...
if I...
You want a glass?
Pour a little in a glass for you. Course.
I will take later. I'm fine now.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. But if you are okay drinking from the bottle, or you
of
need the...
Of course I am.
Okay. I hope it's not too strong because we got the strongest one.
That is strong. Good strong.
Good strong? Okay.
I'm going to eat another cookie.
Yeah, please.
Pulpy, are you jealous? Huh?
So I'm thinking, Richard, regarding you continue doing your business. I open my mouth now. regarding the principle of prasad or grace, I've not yet published by the time we are recording this third book, but somehow I finished writing my fourth book, which will be on God's unconditional love, and I plan to call it probably irreversible grace, because we always use irreversible with damage, right? And we consider ourselves like an irreversible case. I'm irreversibly damaged, so I would like to present it from the only reversible thing that there is irreversible grace, not irreversible damage. And once you receive irreversible grace, there is no coming back from that, that grace.
We think the same.
So basically, I'm also asking for your blessings for the title. Does it sound good, irreversible grace, to you?
Excellent.
Okay. May I ask you then, how this, just to conclude, and I allow you to continue with your ginger beer and cookies more, but how this irreversible grace, how God's mercy is showing up to you in this chapter of your life? If you will have to say something about that.
Well, we mentioned before we started recording, maybe it wasn't. Well, I've had 5 unrelated cancers.
Yeah, that was before the recording. Yeah.
And they want to do a genetic study of my body because I've been healed of all of them. And it's becoming a matter of, I didn't ask, I was ready to die 5 times. And I keep getting healed. It doesn't seem fair.
Mm.
But it's all a question of irreversible momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Why the cancer? Why the healing from the cancer? Both are undeserved. So I have been saying, when we move into the kingdom of grace, what Jesus calls the kingdom of God, I think we stop counting. Counting is useless. Measuring, weighing. Once you stop counting, everybody loses. Everybody. So I don't put much stock in counting anymore. St. Therese of Lisieux, you've heard me speak of her. The little way.
Oh.
Yeah. She said, God knows all the sciences. There's one science God does not know. And everybody is supposed to say, what? It's just God knows nothing about mathematics.
Yeah.
God, she was brilliant. I've got a little relic of her up there. We Catholics have relics, you know.
We also
do. Oh, you do too. Protestants don't like us having relics. Opie. He's got his eyes on it.
The last one open.
Okay. Ooh, Marie's lost taste.
Yeah.
You know what's nice about this is it's so minimally sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just sweet enough to satisfy.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that you mentioned this idea of counting. In our tradition, counting or measuring, the word for that in Sanskrit is maya. Maya translates also as illusion.
Yeah,
but also translates as that which can be measured, like implying whenever you try to measure things.
Oh my goodness!
That
why
call
didn't
it
I
illusion.
Learn that earlier? I could have quoted that.
It's fine. Whenever you try to measure, count, control, it's that translates as illusion. It's an impossible reality.
Thank you for telling me that. And that's from Sanskrit.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very well-known.
Counting is illusion.
Yeah.
Wow. You're the teacher.
You are the teacher. I'm sitting at your feet, Richard.
Well.
What's up?
Opie.
Some ginger beer?
He's at my feet, too. He just wants a cookie, though. You're counting, Opie.
He's counting. How many are left? Okay. Richard will give me half of that.
Give him that half that you put in there.
Sorry?
You put a half a cookie.
Give this for her? For
oh,
him?
Yeah, him.
No, later.
He's lost interest.
Richard, I won't take much of your time anymore. Thank you so
much. Take it. You're counting now. All you do is give. Thank you.
Thanks so much for showing us. I gave you some gift that you are the ones who show me and thousands more that are watching this probably with so many gifts of irreversible grace. So thanks so much for that, and which are way more gifts than the ones I can give you back. So it's just the more I try to reciprocate, the more I indebted I become.
How can we clone you? We got to clone you.
Don't make two Swami Padmanabhas. I have enough with one of those in my own.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you. You're precious.
You are. You are.
Loving God, bless this precious son. He has a word for the world. As it counts its way into capitalism, counting everything. Lead us to the world where we can't count anymore. Amen.
Amen.